The first time that I witnessed white privilege, in other words, privilege because of my white skin, was 6 years ago. Myself and a Costa Rican friend were going through immigration, having come off a cruise in the Emirates. "Wait," said my friend, "and you will see what we endure." "You," he said, "go through one gate, and I'll go through the other. You will be speedily scrutinized, I won't." And sure enough, my friend's passport was, unlike mine, examined minutely. Now, you might think that maybe the Costa Rican passport hadn't a good reputation. Quite the contrary. Like our own, it's highly respected. As you may have guessed, my friend is brown-skinned, as he says himself. In equal proportions, Spanish, African, and indigenous Indian. And it's not only at immigration that he has faced unfair attitudes. In the Costa Rican hotel, situated in a rainforest which he ran and partially owned, you get there by motorboat and are woken at night by howler monkeys banging on your door. Some American guests couldn't initially fathom that he was in fact the boss. And they were rude to him until they realized that he was the person to sort out their supposed dilemma. Their Gucci luggage had got wet in the wash from the boat. Privilege, of course, has many guises. There were the days in early 1930s Ireland when businessmen commonly met twice a day in Bewley's in Dublin. And at the Dublin Horse Show, according to Tony Farmer in his wonderful books Ordinary Lives and Privileged Lives, lean hunting girls who could speak to Galway without using a telephone and their bronze menfolk revved it up, while in the poor areas, 1 in 8 children suffered from malnutrition, over half from dental caries, and 1 in 5 from eye trouble. And in 1932, only 999 children sat the leaving cert. We have to say, of course, today much has changed. In 2 universities alone in Dublin, there are 22,000 students in Trinity, and UCD has 38,000 students. C.S. Todd Andrews, some people will remember him, he's perhaps unfairly vilified for closing down the Harcourt Street railway line. He went to university when student numbers were in their low thousands. While his parents had 2 small businesses, he remembers being looked down on by the sons and especially the daughters of the professional classes. This was a time of deep division in Irish society. The brackets Protestant Craig Gardner accountancy firm got no business for 20 years after the foundation of the state. The tricolour wasn't flown in Lansdowne Road until 1932. And as Brian Inglis has testified, the most common Church of Ireland, and I wonder was it Unitarian as well, attitude to the new state was to abstain. In Inglis's words, as soon as they found out, that's the Church of Ireland found, people found out, that the new Irish government could be trusted not to appropriate their land, debase the currency, or make general legislative mayhem, they settled down to ignore the state's existence. And in everyday matters, the fact that an Irish state did exist was hardly noticeable. Alex Finlater, of the famed Grocery family, said that politics of the Free State was simply not mentioned at Protestant tables. And we know this, membership of the Bull Island Golf Club in Dublin, other things being equal, excluded Roman Catholics, families in trade, and Jews. However, on the Catholic side, according to Todd Andrews, it was assumed that the Irish nation, in the mass, was a classless society, except, of course, for the usual tendency of tuppence halfpenny looking down on tuppence. Although he did say that anyone crossing from Grafton Street over O'Connell Bridge could at once see in the crowd the physical economic effects of the class system. He amusingly recalled how urban anti-treaty Republicans like himself had an austere social creed, refusing to wear formal clothes, disapproving of women wearing makeup, and of elaborate wedding ceremonies. However, within 10 years, they were all joining bridge clubs, sampling alcohol, dining out, and even going to France. In other words, they became privileged, or even more privileged. One of the more amusing aspects of Tony Farmer's research is about the dilemma facing civil servants who had 35% of their salaries based on the consumer price index. This was fine when the index was going up, but in 1929, prices generally fell. And in the words of the Civil Service Federation, the use of the index wasn't fair, as it was based on working class, not middle class, expenditure and lifestyle. It was claimed that the, and probably with some truth, that the average civil servant's household budget contained items which did not appear at all, or only to a negligible extent, in a working class household. Items such as travel expenses, life insurance, restaurant meals and books. And the children's education tended to last longer, and there was normally at least one maid employed. At one stage, in fact, there were 28,000 maids in Dublin. And the civil servants added, the index included items such as third grade margarine, which would not be used by a civil servant, who would also would have purchased in a very different type of shop. So, not unexpectedly, this cementing, even enhancing of privilege and the class system was accepted by the government, giving birth to a newly constructed index and therefore more payment for civil servants. And of course, we have to ask, to the detriment of who? We could forget too, as noted by an American psychologist in 1932, how many people in agriculture worked not for wages, but by virtue of being of their family relationship. The boys working on the family farm had literally no money. If they wanted a drink on market day or to go to a hurling match, they had to get cash from their father. And if they worked in a job away from the farm, the wages were frequently paid to the father and not to them. Such were the social patterns of life in the emerging Ireland, a time when one of the only ways to get a job was through influence. Indeed, as late as 1958, farmer tells us. Aer Lingus infuriated Fianna Fáil backbenchers by telling them that canvassing on behalf of job seekers would disqualify them from consideration. So, after that little foray into our state's early years, it is perhaps time to ask how we now deal with the ethical aspects of being privileged, as many of us, perhaps most of us, are. Like most people, I think, I feel extremely grateful for having been born in Europe, in Ireland, and to be living in a pleasant Dublin suburb. But first, let's look at United States experience, some of which pertain to the earlier yarn about my Costa Rican friend's encounter with Emirati immigration, and might indeed help us to construct a paradigm on how we might honorably use our privilege. A Global Citizen article stresses that having privilege doesn't mean that an individual is immune from life's hardships. But it does mean having an unearned benefit or advantage that a person receives because of race, gender, sexual orientation, country of origin, language, or ability. Aja Hales, who is described as a social thinker, puts it this way. A privilege is a right or immunity granted as a particular benefit, advantage, or favor. If you're the US president, he says, you cannot go to jail if you are in office. And a Duke University publication tells us that there's a long history of privilege bringing attention to the unearned advantage and inherent power imbalance of certain individuals and groups. And very briefly, we might look at some American cases involving the legal system and see whether we could experience something similar. 8 years ago in Memphis in Tennessee, four black males in hoodies were escorted from a shopping mall for violating the dress code. A week later, at the same shopping center, four white women walked around the center for 2 hours in hoodies and jeans before they were politely asked to remove their hoodies. They weren't ejected and they weren't arrested. But while, of course, we tend to concentrate on discrimination against minority groups, there is often a failure to record what is called privileged omissions. They are a practice of discriminatory inaction that excuses failures to comply with expected standards and rules because of a person's privileged status. A decision maker might, for example, grant exceptions to a privileged person, excusing him or her from the accepted norms in rules and behavior. And such decisions, according to a man called Kenneth Culp Davis, on when to be lenient can be misleading and undermine justice. There was a story in the United States, Florida Highway Patrol got involved in the practice of speed discounting, favoring certain people by recording their speeding at a lower level. Such bias in favor or privileged omission is not amenable to being highlighted. Indeed, the beneficiaries may be oblivious to the advantage they have received, or perceive their experience as normal or deserved, perpetuating a cycle of inequality. Privileged omissions, it is said, reinforce the status quo by keeping the infractions of privileged individuals out of the public eye. We are told how if white students and black students display the same level of unacceptable behavior, privileged omissions could excuse the white students from punishment. And similar biases can also occur in hiring and firing. And although reported outside Ireland, these practices force us to examine the extent to which we allow ourselves to exercise our privilege, overtly or covertly, fairly or unfairly, and the extent to which we either take advantage of privileged omissions or exercise it. Lee Ann Royster of Duke University says we should not feel guilty about our privilege and we shouldn't want to give it up, but rather we should use our power and privilege to do things effectively around equity and inclusion. In our privilege, we should at least seek to facilitate others to an equality similar to that of ourselves. We should perhaps be chipping away at the use of entitlements which disfavor others, examining those areas of Irish life which evade scrutiny. Given the nature of work, is it an unfair privilege that only one third of Irish workers are able to work from home? I'm not so sure. When we hear a barrister pleading that, quotes, no useful purpose would be served by jailing this young man who would find prison unduly hard, are we alert to class bias? How does it, or antennae, respond when wealthy citizens fight like dervishes to stop the erection of social houses or traveller sites near them? Should Indigenous Irish have first rights over new arrivals to school places in a local area? When Minister for Justice, the late Des O'Malley, said in the 1970s that prison conditions were often better than those in the homes of inmates, what did that tell us about privilege in our country? If we buy a monstrous heavy car, how many people are we depriving of public space and clean air? And perhaps most pertinent of all, is there an ethical cap on the extent to which we should fight for our privileges when we don't examine whether this fight is undermining the rights of others? If we campaign, as many people do, for the tax-free threshold on inheritances to be increased, how many hospital beds, carers' salaries, and disability aids could be lost? Is it not unjust and contrary to the common good that as parents die, families keep accumulating generation after generation, with adult children in comfortable middle and upper class areas being left with up to €400,000 tax-free without a means test or perhaps assessment for any special needs? Never before, we are told by the central bank, has there been so much intergenerational wealth in Ireland. Is this the society that we want? One where the already privileged are being given even more privilege at the expense of the common good? For those who don't agree with this, let us accept that there is a wider message, that we should be wary of how our privilege and seeking more of it can be to the detriment of others. We should perhaps be wary of skipping, as I did once, a medical clinic queue because the consultant was a former teammate. I feel ashamed of that nearly 40 years later. And as the Duke University academic enjoins us, we should use the privilege that we have to encourage equity and inclusion. We should ask ourselves whether our attitudes to society and in politics reinforce the privileges of a certain set of people to the detriment of others. When Jennifer Roche, if I'm pronouncing her correctly, wife of Peter Hegseth, the US Secretary for Defense, wore a gown worth $42, was she doing it in solidarity with those who can't afford more? As an example of good housekeeping, apparently Washington is agog, and if so, was she aware that a gown of that price most probably came from an Asian sweatshop? And to conclude, it's the kind of question we perhaps should ask ourselves, for example, when we buy fast fashion or use probably carcinogenic weed killers. If nothing else, the experiences outlined above would hopefully sharpen our antennae in balancing our rights with those of others. And such balances help to make us truly human. Thank you.